This is Audible.
Audible Studios presents Cocaine Plus Surfing, a sordid history of surfing's greatest love affair. Written by Chaz Smith, performed by Tom Pyle.
Prologue. It's cold outside, gray, heavy sweater weather. Maybe even thin down-filled jacket paired with stocking cap weather. And it smells like cow, like manure, wet feed, and sour milk. Which only makes sense, since we're in Lemoore, California, the official home of cows, more cows, and Chaz Smith's damned ex-wife. Just kidding. My damned ex-wife is from neighboring Visalia, but all of inland central California is basically the same thing, and a place I swore I'd never return. Then Kelly Slater went and created the perfect wave here. Yes, the world's most celebrated surfer decided, as he neared retirement, to shake a tanned fist at God and man make a legitimately perfect wave using some patented plow in what used to be a water ski lake in what used to be my damned ex-wife's general neighborhood some 100 miles away from the ocean, all cow stinky and gray. A wave that barrels properly, that drives down the length of the Green Lake and barrels perfectly every single time. Nothing like this has ever been done. Previous wave pools create a surf that dribbles along in an embarrassing, weak, low-energy kind of way. Kelly's wave pool fires the imagination. Even surfers who travel the world riding the ocean's best waves are clamoring for an invite. Surf Ranch is what they're calling it, and it's the jewel in the World Surf League's crown. Surfing as a sport has always been hampered by nature, by God. Sometimes waves show up, sometimes they don't. And how's a sporting event supposed to be held in such randomness? The football field doesn't change, and neither does the basketball court, so the World Surf League purchased the Surf Ranch property and its patented plow technology from Kelly Slater in order to equalize the arena, to make surfing a proper sport. And so the new World Surf League CEO invited me and 12 crusty surf journalists and surf photographers up to surf and witness the future. She's trying to understand what we are, God bless her, trying to figure out what makes our hearts beat. The last CEO, Mr. Paul Speaker, came from the National Football League and was a dipshit and refused each of my impassioned pleas for an interview. So I made fun of him every day in the surf media until he got fired. The new CEO, Ms. Sophie Goldschmidt, came from the Women's National Basketball Association and seems to be taking an honest shot at knowing what this is all about. And so here I am in the cold and gray and stink, listening to her give us all a warm introduction. "I'm so glad you could all be here with us today," she says in a proper British accent. "Everyone is going to have so much fun, I trust, and this safety briefing will ensure just that. We're very proud of what we've built." She's tall, pretty, with eyes that look too innocent for all this and a smile that looks too pure, and I don't know if I'll be able to muster the internal strength to make fun of her every day. "Before we begin, though, I think it's only right to recognize that today is the day that Andy Irons passed away." The room is silent. "I never had the privilege of meeting him, though I know many of you knew him very well. And as I learn about surfing's history, it is clear what an impact he had." 11 of the 12 crusty surf journalists and surf photographers keep their eyes down. I look sideways at my best Australian pal, business partner, who looks like he's in a bad spot, having had 4 or maybe 6 too many whiskey sodas the previous night. She clears her throat after what feels too long. "And now, allow me to introduce you to our head of water safety." The head of water safety is a handsome man who tells us not to screw around. But I'm thinking about Andy Irons and not the dislocated shoulder I'm going to get in 2 hours by screwing around. Andy Irons, the 3-time champ from Hawaii, died November 2nd, 2010, alone in a Dallas hotel room, from what the county's medical officer concluded was cardiac arrest due to a severe blockage of a heart artery and acute mixed drug ingestion, including Xanax, methadone, and metabolites of cocaine. He was 32 years old. The causes of his death surprised no one in this cloistered world. Every crusty surf journalist and surf photographer in this room had either gone big with him, cocaine everywhere, dusting everything, or caught him in full pinpricked pupil, incessant prattle mode. He was a giant character, but also not an outlier. And while his death was an utter tragedy, it was not necessarily a shock. Drugs and surfing, especially cocaine, felt synonymous with professional surfing those 8-odd years ago. It still does. It's always snowing in Orange County, or so they say. And I look at Sophie. She's listening intently to the head of water safety at a perfect man-made wave, trying to turn this professional surfing into a proper sport while also respecting its past, God bless her. But as long as I'm around, that ain't happening. Surfing, at its core, is an unruly, fouled, smutty disaster. Its past littered with felons, smugglers, addicts, narcissists, and creeps. Its present defined by crusty surf journalists and surf photographers. Its future a certain disaster. But it's our disaster. Our glorious disaster. Chapter 1. The Call to Adventure. I can smell the saltwater rot each time the shoe bounces off my temple, each time it grinds into my cheek. And it must be a Volcom Creedler, because its owner is a professional surfer, sponsored by the surf brand Volcom, and has been forever. But I don't have the luxury of looking over and finding out, because I have to concentrate on driving in a straightish line. Don't fucking say anything! Don't fucking tell him anything! The kicks are now accompanied by shouting. Don't fucking... Then giggling, and then more shouting. You're fucking right about it. He's a fucking surf journalist. As the shoe retreats for a moment, I sigh, readjust the rearview mirror, and study the gyrating ball wedged up against the car seat in the back seat of my Volkswagen Jetta wagon. The professional surfer is wearing a black sweatshirt featuring Volcom's new tagline, Live for This, and I see it getting ripped while his tan arms try to protect his ribs from a barrage of jabbing, pulling fists, bushy hair everywhere. Don't fucking surf journalist! To be honest, I'm amazed that this particular surfer is still sponsored at all. Volcom sold to French multinational Curing a few years ago for $600 million, and by all accounts is a total dud. The luxury group hoped to position it next to its other brands, Saint Laurent, Gucci, Balenciaga, and McQueen, except Volcom's old tagline was Youth Against Establishment, and its signature product is still a t-shirt featuring an owl over the words, Who Farted? Sales are lagging far behind expectations, and brand managers, team managers, executive vice presidents, and professional surfers are getting cut like it's the reign of terror. Those who haven't been fired are gripped by a toxic panic that manifests itself in a rigid conservatism. Executives from Disney and the NFL were hired to try and make things right, but things only get more conservative, more buttoned up, tighter. The look and feel of ExxonMobil. A true apocalypse. Or maybe the youth just aren't against the establishment these days. Maybe they're cool with it. Maybe they live for something else, not this. Or maybe it's just a little too transparently anti-establishment to be part of a giant French multinational that changed its name from PPR to Curing because it sounds like caring. Whatever the case, it was Curing's initial investment that allowed Volcom to make its first closed-toe shoe, the Creedler, a misguided attempt at replicating Vans Classic, which failed beyond badly because nobody can replicate the Vans Classic, not even Saint Laurent. Fucking surf journalist! The guy shouting is also a professional surfer, except sponsored by Reef. He has pinned Volcom completely now, and might be pinching his nipples or twisting them. Reef is owned by VF Corporation, which coincidentally owns Vans. Reef is tail-spinning almost as bad as Volcom, but the brand's sponsored surfer is doing well, at least right now in this particular physical exchange. Wailing, jabbing, pulling, ripping, screaming, angry. Winning in a mixed martial arts style I would not have thought him capable of. I wonder if he's wearing a pair of Reef's Mick Fanning signature beer bottle opening sandals. Yes, Reef literally and honestly makes a sandal with a bottle opener on the bottom. Like, you walk down the street on your way to a friend's barbecue, walk through dog urine, or bum urine, or horse urine, depending, I suppose, on where your friend lives, then get to his house, go to his backyard, open his cooler, grab a beer, take your sandal off, and use its bottom to pop the cap. Literally. Honestly. But I can't see from my angle if he's wearing them or not, and the two keep shifting and squirming, gyrating, and the anger level seems to be rising. Fucking don't fucking surf journalist! And then it hits another level. I think Reef is jamming his hand into Volcom's mouth while twisting his nipples. I think he's trying to remove teeth or a tongue. I'm gonna whip around and say, knock it off, you two, I'm driving here. But I don't know how to deliver the line without sounding ridiculously paternal, especially in a station wagon featuring a baby car seat, so I accept the abuse. Plus, I'm getting a little curious about this story that's so secret that it's causing one grown professional surfer in the twilight of his career to smash another, also in the twilight of his career, in the back seat of a soccer mom car. The Creedler. It's totally a Creedler. I can see it now with its misshapen toe and too high rise. Brushes past my nose and then slams into my eye, and I swerve, almost crossing into oncoming traffic. The kicking stops along with the shouting. In my rearview mirror, the fighters are adjusting themselves, maybe scared straight, maybe calming down. But then the giggling starts up again. So is Dad. I glance back in the rearview mirror. Reef is sitting sullenly, arms crossed over the words on his sweatshirt that read, "Just Passing Through," which is that brand's tagline, looking out the window and apparently accepting his fate. I again try to see if he's wearing the beer sandal, but his feet are down in the dark spaces. In the dark spaces I get in trouble for never cleaning, and which usually have crushed up banana bits and gluten-free pretzels and sometimes organic preschool art projects floating about. I hope he's wearing the Mick Fanning signature sandals so bad, he'll have a real treat when he opens his next beer. Volcom is sitting upright and trying to get it all out between fits of glee, but still in a protective hunch, waiting for the pain to potentially start again. In the traditional pose of youth against establishment. His old mate was out walking with one of his friends in the bush near Bluey's, right? They were near Bluey's. He looks over at Reef, who is not about to provide help, but then Volcom doesn't need it because he remembers suddenly. It was Bluey's because they have all those koala crossings in the trees over the road there. So the two of them were walking together, and the friend asked him if he knew that koalas were getting STDs and heaps of them were dying. An old mate said he didn't believe him at first, but he kept going on and saying shit like, "Yeah, it's chlamydia, and heaps of them are dying, but the worst part is that the drop bears are getting it now, too." An old mate said he didn't believe it, but later that day was caught out at the pub with, and he's having difficulty containing himself, with a dinger on his head. He is laughing so hard now that his spasms are shaking the car, while Reef angrily yells, "Fuck you, fuck you. He's gonna fucking write about it now, thanks." And not in a funny, joking way either, leaving me to really wonder how in the hell either of them thought this story would possibly be interesting to anyone, especially an American. It's only by the grace of God and enough time spent living in Australia that I can piece together the narrative by half understanding the pertinent bits. Drop bears are a regional folklore. I think maybe carnivorous koalas that drop from the trees onto unsuspecting heads and eat them, or turn them into koala zombies, like chupacabras, maybe. Something like that. A dinger, I know for sure, is regional slang for condom. Or maybe for sure. Australian slang moves faster than greased lightning. Bluey's I've got. It's a sandbar wedge somewhere near Newcastle. Or maybe it's that river mouth closer to Coolangatta. In fairness, I suppose the story has its moments, but it's not the sort that could be written without many explanatory segues, and I still don't see how it would reflect poorly on anyone but the father, and, mostly, who in their right mind would care. A wave of depression washes over me. This kicking, this pointlessness, this wildly oversensitive guarding of even the most ludicrous information, drop bears and STDs, is my lot in life, because Reef is right. I am a surf journalist. A fucking surf journalist. And it wasn't supposed to be this way. I was supposed to have waved goodbye to the shallow end of the swimming pool years ago. I was supposed to be a Pulitzer Prize-winning war reporter by now, spilling valuable words on the plight of Syrian refugees while dodging bullets. Or maybe in the White House briefing room, being shouted down by the press secretary for speaking truth to power. Or front row at the Fendi show in Paris, across from Anna Wintour, noting that the monster collection pairs playful and classic in a delightfully Lagerfeldian way. Or writing a coming-of-age novel set in Palm Springs during the White Party. Or scribbling my third New Yorker story of the year about the joys of fatherhood and winning yet another Pulitzer. Or anywhere but here. Thankfully, we arrive at our destination, the godforsaken Shore Break Hotel in Huntington Beach, pausing my tortured reflection, or almost pausing it. How does a surf journalist look at 60? Does he look like an asshole? Does he just completely cave and wear the Reef Mick Fanning beer-opening sandal? Is drinking urine his penance for hanging on to a young man's game way too long? I park 4 blocks away in the first space I see, under a strange fat pine, and I'm happy to leave, but no one seems in a hurry. Bolcom is still giggling. Reef is digging in his pants pocket. And then he pulls an inch-by-inch Ziploc baggie. And then he's dumping white powder on the Jetta's center console, organizing it into 3 straight lines. And then he's rolling up a dollar bill. He sniffs the first up his nose in 1 quick snort, hands the dollar bill to his erstwhile Volcom antagonist, and the sniff is repeated, and then up to me. Thanks for driving, mate. Reef is now happy. I put on my fake cheer and say, no worries, glad you found me, while handing the dollar bill back to him. Go for it, mate, it's yours, he says, nodding to the lonely line. I'm good, I say. He shrugs, bends over, and takes care of what's left, then brushes the console off, rubs his finger against his gums, and opens his door. Minutes ago, he was smashing the shit out of his friend so some non-sequitur weirdness could stay hidden from a surf journalist. Now he's just finished smashing a good bit of blow and dried apple juice, kid dirt from an organic preschool, and God only knows what else, without even pausing. It was kind that he offered some up, though. Australians, even the complete derelicts, are usually generous. When I was very young, my family took a camping trip down the California coast, and in the redwoods we ran into some Australians who had locked their keys in their car. They stood outside of it, very frustrated, not knowing what to do. My dad, having insisted on only ever owning old and perpetually broken cars, quickly fashioned a small hook out of a hanger, fished it down their door, and popped their locks. They were so grateful that they gave him a giant can of Foster's. He took it, thanked them, and we got back on the road. I sat in the back leaning over and staring at that can of beer. They had pronounced it beer. Thanks for your help, mate. Here, take a beer. And I couldn't believe my dad had taken it. I had never seen him with alcohol in his hand. I had never seen him drink, and as far as I knew, he never had. We were Christians, and Christians didn't drink, smoke, swear, or gamble. But there the Fosters sat next to him on the bench seat of our 1981 Ford Econoline, big, glistening, still cold. It represented all the sin in the entire world to me, all of hell's hot fire. At the next gas stop, he threw it away. I asked him why he'd taken it. Why hadn't he told them that he didn't drink beer because we were Christians? He told me that they were just being friendly with what they had, and it was rude to turn people down to their faces when they didn't know any better. And look at me all these years later, not following in my father's footsteps. Being totally rude to two Australians who definitely don't know any better. Then again, my dad had never gotten between two Australian surfers and their cocaine, or any surfers and their cocaine, for that matter. It is cherished far more than beer, far more than maybe anything except surfing. The two pursuits have become more or less synonymous. Cocaine and surfing, surfing and cocaine. So synonymous, in fact, that the thought I'll write about lines being done off my center console doesn't even register as a potential liability, unlike the possibility of STDs being passed on to the unsuspecting via mythical koalas, which had created spasms of rage. Reef swings the back door open and is followed by Volcom, and then I follow too because I'm depressed about my urine-drinking future and need to drown my sorrows in something proper, or at least proper while I'm still almost young. We walk four blocks under palms and a tree that smells like semen, past Dr. Ding Surfboard Repair, past Chuck Dent Surfboards, past an off-brand acai bowl place, past North Shore Poke Company, and to the Shore Break, a monument to bad taste, featuring a font not even a first-year design student would find appropriate. A colorway that screams, "What?" A restaurant named Zimzala that's getting changed into a restaurant named Pacific Hideaway, but nobody knows that yet. We walk up the stairs, past giant portraits of professional surfer stars that look like they were shot in a studio at Sears, to the packed bar. Even though the surf industry apocalypse, the unrelenting reign of terror. Everyone here is going to get fired tomorrow, probably. Still, sweat is dripping from the ceiling down the walls. The surf industry still enjoys partying like it's 1991. I don't think it knows any other way. People are yelling loud nothings into each other's ears with clenched jaws. Beer is being bought, but not consumed, just swung around by its neck and spilled onto an impossibly sticky floor. The Sears surf stars are staring down from the walls. They know how this feels, and they aren't judging. A highlight reel of some damn surf contest that happened 6 years ago in Portugal plays on the overhead televisions. The bathroom line stretches through Zimzala, pinpricked pupils and sweat and jaw muscles. Some terrible reggae plays over the sound system, and a 6-year-old Portugal contest, and conspiracies and loud, loud conversations yelled into ears, and wiping noses and rubbing noses, and jittery movements, and much blinking, and attempts at dancing, except how can reggae be danced to in any era? I know way too many people here. I know almost all of them, and I shouldn't be here. I should be in Damascus, or Washington, D.C., or Paris, or Stockholm, accepting my Pulitzer. Or probably not Pulitzer, if I'm going to look at my talent level honestly. But what is the Golden Globes for writing? I should not be a surf journalist in any case, and my depression is as encompassing as a Balenciaga Blizzard wool blend sweater, as enveloping as it must be for the Keurig executive who had the brilliant idea to buy the surf brand Volcom for $600 million. Keurig, ha! Huh. I think to myself, as a pair of too serious for the moment board short designers race past, mumbling something about the genius of Joseph, or maybe Thomas, Campbell. I bet high fashion thinks it has surfing beat with regards to cocaine. I bet Saint Laurent and Gucci and Balenciaga and McQueen each feel they've done them some cocaine. That they know cocaine, that they're intimates, that they have lived that cocaine life. But I once became a male model to impress my wife and got to see the way that fashion thinks about and uses cocaine. It's all right, I guess. They've done a pretty good job, but they're also fickle. Same with music, art, finance, politics, real proper sports, and the culinary industry. Sometimes cocaine is in vogue and that's what everyone's doing, but then it falls out of style and the restaurateurs get into meth. The artists get onto an acid revival. The musicians get into MDMA. The politicians find PCP. The real proper sportsmen get some HGH and weed. And the financiers crush up low-dose naltrexone and smoke it, while the models indulge in bath salts. Surfing's flame for cocaine has never dimmed, has never even flickered. She has loved her cocaine virtuously, decorously, passionately, almost monogamously, since as long as I've been around. And I rack my brain, while the surf industry jitters around me, trying to imagine two things more inextricably enmeshed. Vlad Putin and sick judo skills? No. While it certainly feels like a hot affair, those two have only canoodled since 1960. Donald J. Trump and hyperbole? A long time, yes, but the man also sometimes dallies with vicious understatement. Gay men and mustaches? A beautiful relationship, to be sure, and maybe ancient, but not even close to monogamous. Surfing and cocaine are rare, like elderly, semi-perverse grandparents who've been married forever, yet still can't keep their hands off each other. The room smells like 1991 and is packed with surfers necking beers but not drinking and trying to dance, talking loudly, and rubbing noses vigorously while solving the world's problems, even though they're very paranoid that the world is out to get them, and I wonder if this is why I'm still a surf journalist. That God wants me to share a bizarre love story. A love story loftier than anything William Shakespeare ever wrote, or at least longer lasting. A love story with more heat than any Ryan Gosling has ever been in, including The Notebook. A love story that both sickens the stomach and soars the heart. Could it be? Is this my special purpose? What I was born to do? What I've been searching for? Cocaine? Chapter 2. Refusal of the call. No. I feel a surge of existential disgust and push through the paranoia and reggae and Sears portraits. Past some big wave surfer who's rumored to be a swinger, run down the stairs and through the doors out onto Fifth Street. The air feels hot, heavy. Manufactured, but that has more to do with this part of Huntington Beach's 2009 faux urban vibe. I can't breathe. I can't fucking breathe. And I tug on my Turbo Negro poly cotton blend sweater, trying to assist oxygen through my neck and into my lungs, then become self-conscious when I remember I haven't been surfing in 2 weeks and so my wetsuit neck tan has faded entirely away. If any surf industry bros catch me out here without a neck tan, I'll be doomed. They'll tell everyone I haven't been surfing in at least 2 weeks, maybe even longer, and my house of cards will collapse, so I leave my sweater alone and let it cover my shame. But it's so hot, and I'm walking fast and getting hotter, skinny palm trees swaying against an iconic orange night sky overhead. A lone seagull bellows somewhere down by the pier. I should have run up the street and found my car under its fat pine and driven anywhere, driven home, but I didn't. And now I'm walking aimlessly down the PCH before turning up Main Street, eyes down, refraining from tugging on my sweater, just trying to breathe. Passing Jack's surf shop, passing Perk's nightclub, and wondering if I should duck into another bar to order double vodkas and calm down. but I can't risk running into any more surf industry bros. Not in this state, anyhow. Not with this lack of wetsuit neck tan. So I keep walking. And do you remember what you wanted to be when you grew up? Was it something that would have benefited the greater good? An artist? A dancer? Teacher? Poet? Fireman? Superhero? President? Prime Minister? Astronaut? Did you become it? Are you happy? Are you benefiting the greater good? Nobody dreams of becoming a surf journalist. I fantasized about being a marine biologist when I was 8 years old, before it became clear to everyone, including me, that I was not mentally equipped to deal with observable facts and shit. But then it did become clear, and I shifted toward wanting to become a Stinger missile-smuggling medical missionary like my Uncle Dave. I studied in Egypt, traveled in Syria, Yemen, Somalia, and Azerbaijan with two fabulous co-conspirators. Learned enough Arabic to sound like an asshole. I never got to smuggle Stinger missiles, but had some fine adventures right as the world tumbled headlong into the age of radical Islam. I wrote about some of them for magazines, like about grime music in Somalia and how to run from Al-Qaeda on a 150cc motorcycle in the Marib, and decided that I was a great new journalist. I was the second coming of Norman Mailer, except whoever the Golden Globes version is. And then Israel invaded Lebanon, and there I went, ending up in a Hezbollah dungeon. At that moment, I cursed my fate, my recklessness, and begged God for a way out. Any way out. He answered my prayers and took me away from the Hezbollah dungeon, and the bizarre interrogator who kept insisting that Jenny Garth from Beverly Hills 90210 was super cute. Away from radical Islam and war and missiles. He took me to surf, and I breathed a sigh of relief, thinking, phew. And Jenny Garth is okay, but not super cute. Though I totally admitted to the bizarre interrogator that she was hotter than Beyonce. Things a man will do to save his fingernails. A honking horn startles me into the present. It's an older model Toyota Camry with two surfboards strapped to the top, fins down, cruising very slowly down Main Street, clearly from Chino or Riverside. Nobody who knows ever puts a board on a car with its fins down. I've sat through raging, multiple hours-long debates over whether it's better to put fins forward or put fins back, but never, ever, ever down. It's one of the infinite ways to be a kook. Surfers are a strange breed in this way. The amount of subcontextual notes and cues, the number of do's and don'ts, mostly don'ts, is staggering, knee-buckling. Don't walk down the beach with your leash attached to your leg. Don't hype a hurricane swell. Don't paddle out with more than two friends. Don't claim a turn. Don't exaggerate wave height. Do wildly undersell wave height. Don't wear a neoprene surf hat. Don't wear anything except a black wetsuit in the water. Don't ever wear a spring suit, ever. Don't talk in the lineup. Keep your hands in your armpits in the lineup. Don't keep your hands in your armpits in the lineup if another surfer already has his hands in his armpits. Don't rub sand in your wax before paddling out. Sometimes, rub sand in your wax before paddling out, depending on 30 distinct factors. Don't surf with a buckled knee, because then everyone will think you're trying to copy professional surfer Craig Anderson, and nothing could be more transparently try-hard in the moment than trying to copy professional surfer Craig Anderson. Don't try hard. Etc. Ad infinitum. There are more unwritten rules than there are Hindu gods, and the sum of these subtleties, utterly devoid of any real value, is what makes up the surfer's mind. He is so oppressively shallow because his mind is stuttering over things like this, over where to put his hands in the lineup, how to put his boards on his car, if his neck tan is as delineated as it should be. God took me from the Hezbollah dungeon to surf, anyhow, and at first I breathed a giant sigh of relief and thought, I'll kick here until the dust settles. I'd always loved surfing, and it felt wonderful to follow the professional surf tour to perfectly non-dangerous France, Australia, and Tahiti, to write about beaches and sun and waves. I was living the life, and after a few years, my batteries were sufficiently charged. It was time to go back to war. I figured my way out was to write a surf book where I burned all my bridges. So I wrote one about Oahu's North Shore, a place no surf industry person really talks about publicly because it's violent and filled with scary people. Slaps, cracks, chokeouts, spam, false cracks, and knocks on the head. The surf industry person doesn't like any of these things and will generally shy away from direct conflict if he can, preferring to passively, aggressively avoid his enemy. But he also has to go to the North Shore every winter, where passive-aggressive avoidance doesn't work, and he doesn't want to get smashed for anything that could be misinterpreted as disrespectful, and so he spends a month each year with his eyes darting, his mouth shut, and scared. If I wrote a book about it, I'd be committing surf industry seppuku and become an untouchable corpse. Welcome to paradise, now go to hell. Was supposed to be a complete disembowelment. It was supposed to get surfing's living nightmare furious with me. Somehow, though, surfing's living nightmare liked it. Or maybe liked it. Eddie, Fast Eddie Rothman, the man who runs the North Shore like a scarred knuckle don, was the book's star and couldn't be dreamt up even by the most ludicrous imagination. He's compact, powerful, tough. With a voice like thunder and a grip like pain. He's also somehow Jewish and from Philadelphia. When he walks into a room, the surf industry person begins shaking and quietly praying that Fast Eddie will go talk to someone else, anyone else. I spent time with him, yeah, but he was angry with me before the book came out, maybe anticipating an unfair portrayal. He called me and gave me an earful of hell, and I thought, good. No more surf for sure. But he called me again 6 months after it came out and chuckled his low, guttural chuckle. You know, you write fucking good. It's a funny book. Son of a bitch. Thanks, Eddie. Thanks a lot. It was also supposed to get the surf industry, so staid and conservative, to toss me out on my ear for telling too many secrets and making fun of too many surf industry executives. I wrote gleefully about how one executive from Billabong, the largest surf company at the time, was slapped by Fast Eddie, and how he deserved it. That Billabong executive later became a major part of the professional surf tour, now called the World Surf League, and I thought, so long. But I still wasn't tossed out. I was simply passively, aggressively avoided and whispered about, and generally not liked by everyone in the World Surf League except its senior vice president of global identity. I toyed around with the non-surf epics I would write. Infiltrating gangs that deal in black market food, tentatively titled in my mind, Tonight We Dine in Hell. Or infiltrating American separatist groups, tentatively titled Reports from Hell Before Breakfast. Or sailing a boat from Yemen to Egypt around a Saudi blockade tentatively titled Al-Jahim, Hell in Arabic. They were my destiny, what I was meant to do, but I couldn't get any internal traction on the topics. I'd feel inspired, and then the inspiration would get mashed beneath shit-stirring and surfing, and so I slunk back to surf journalism to pen such instant classics as Advice, Self-Motivation is Overrated, and How to Change Without a Towel, trying to find some sort of meaning where no meaning exists. Fucking surfers. Fucking surf journalism. Fucking below-the-knee surf trunks. I walk past the Billabong store and see they've debuted a collection featuring Andy Warhol's art on surf trunks and T-shirts. A giant cardboard printout in the window features his quote, "I came out of the womb on a surfboard." Did he really say that? What's it even supposed to mean? Andy Warhol never had a neck tan, and for sure, never surfed. Pop culture's dance with surfing is always a funny thing. I suppose if surfers had any sort of understandable depth, or any depth, full stop, then Hollywood would have pounced on them as archetypes and figured out long ago how to capture the specifics enough to make a surf blockbuster. But have you seen Hollywood's surf films? Have you seen Chasing Mavericks, or Blue Crush, or Point Break, either of them, or North Shore, or Big Wednesday, or The Perfect Wave, or Soul Surfer, or In God's Hands? The best of them are laughably bad. The worst, a forgettable cringe. Hollywood can't get the surfer even halfway right, and I think it's a proximity issue. Many in Hollywood, many directors and producers and actors think they surf. Their glittering town, perched on the Pacific, causes them to believe they know what it all means because they walk out of Malibu homes, grab a goofy yellowed 7-foot pintail, and go sit in the puddle out front. But surfing and belonging to surf are two entirely separate things. Belonging to surf, in my definition, is to be part of the surf industrial complex. Those who either work for a surf brand in some capacity as a photographer, writer, shaper, or who have at some point in their lives. Those who have so oriented their lives around surf that they watch World Surf League events, even while chatting about professional surfer form on message boards. Those whose productivity slowly drains away because they surf instead of working. Those who have pterygium. And that is exactly what Hollywood is missing as it relates to the surfer. Pterygium, also called surfer's eye. What WebMD describes as a growth of pink fleshy tissue on the conjunctiva, the clear tissue that lines your eyelids and covers your eyeball. It usually forms on the side closest to your nose and grows toward the pupil area. Quite basically, pterygia are scales. Scales that begin growing over the eye because surfers sit out in the water long enough thinking about where to put their hands, and so God, in his transcendence, knows that they will go blind and puts scales over their eyes to protect them from the sun's fiery wrath as it bounces off the water. They don't generally cause blindness, but they cause blurriness of vision. Surfers have scales covering their eyes. I have never met a director or producer with scales covering his. And I've only met one actor who might be close to having them, Jimmy Kahn's boy, Scott. But almost every real surfer, every professional surfer, or surf brand manager, or executive vice president to the bros, has either full-blown pterygium, or the beginnings of pterygium, or bones covering the inside of his ears, also known as surfer's ear. He has chosen surfing over clear eyesight, or over hearing, sometimes over both. Scott Kahn went one better, too. He chose to star in the remake of Hawaii Five-O just so he could surf. My own baby pterygia make me look stoned all the time. I don't smoke weed. Surfing truly is a wild obsession that must have begun in a place so fantastic that the surfer's reptilian brain was seared forever with its preeminence. A place more glorious than human vision can contain, thus making it redundant. A place where palm trees sway in warm trade breezes, and the water's not so cold, and the waves are plentiful and iconic and perfect. Surfing must have begun in Hawaii, where Scott Kahn actively shoots his career in the foot. A tropical paradise floating proud in the blue Pacific. Islands of frangipani and hula and aloha and mahalo. Islands of pipeline and Waimea and pupukea and peahi and Hanalei, islands of surf, a dream better than eyesight, hearing, or proper acting work, right? Surf and Hawaii do make sense together. They belong together, and it feels as if the 50th state birthed the wave sliding onto the world. But did you know that surfing came to Hawaii along with hula and coconuts and gods and goddesses from Tahiti? It was on those towering, craggy, postcardy, equally gorgeous green folds that Polynesian power consolidated, then moved outward. The ancient Polynesians never figured out how to write language or make a wheel or dig metals from the ground, but they could sail like no people had sailed before, or likely will ever sail again. With neither map nor compass, they would push off into the vast Pacific, discover new islands, populate them, plant coconuts, sacrifice people by crushing their bones, and make their way back home again. The ocean was their world, and they would sail by constellation, by cloud pattern, by current, by smell. And the first European explorers to travel the Micronesian and Polynesian islands could not believe these primitives could sail so well. It was a popular belief at the time that God simply planted them on their islands. Later, when science replaced God as the du jour belief system, the world's foremost thinkers assumed Polynesia's islands were the remains of sunken continents, and the inhabitants were the sad detritus of once great civilizations. All the way until the 1960s, scholars were confused as to how islanders got to their islands. Their methods were simply too rudimentary to be able to navigate the Great Pacific, and their boats too shitty. Human navigation, even at its most European sophisticated, is a total junk show when compared to that of other animals. We don't read magnetic fields or innately know true north. We can't follow multi-generational, multi-thousand-mile travel patterns like the monarch butterfly. We can't even count our steps and dead reckon like the Sahara Desert ant, or at least not without a Fitbit. But the ancient Micronesians and Polynesians, the Pacific Islanders, were good enough to make the animal kingdom blush and to make the sophisticated European seem like the backward cave dweller that he is. They were not subpar at all. They were magnificent. The Marshall Islanders, to the north and west of Tahiti, had a system, for example. There are 5 main islands and 29 atolls occupying some 70 square miles, and they were completely isolated from each other and from any bigger landmass. Over the millennia, they established a system called wave piloting, in order to get around with an almost inhuman sense, and it almost disappeared from the face of the earth because we decided to test our gorgeous hydrogen bombs there. Thankfully, miraculously, an old Marshallese man and his younger cousin revived the art. The old man, you see, had been trained as a raimeto, or person of the sea, as a boy, but didn't actually get his official title from the island's chief, as was the tradition, because he had not taken the test because of the hydrogen bomb testing. For thousands of years, raimetos were minted on the islands. They would learn the art and then get pushed out to sea and have to find their way to some island or another on their first try. If they didn't make it, they would die alone under the stars, sharks circling. If they shared their secrets to any non-raimeto, they would be killed on land. In any case, the art was reading the refracted swell that bounced off the islands and atolls. To be able to read these patterns of swirl in the middle of the ocean, through sight, but mostly by feel. They would lie on their backs, eyes closed, feeling the chop hit the canoe, and know how far land was, and which direction it was, and where to go. No wonder the first Europeans supposed the hand of God dropped people, and the godless scientists believed in sunken continents, because both make more sense than reading wave chop by feel way out at sea. The old man, anyhow, knew the art would die with him if he didn't do anything, so he got a special dispensation from his chief to be able to teach his younger cousin. And I'm sorry to be so far down a Baroque segue here, but have you ever been out on the Pacific, like deep Pacific, away from any land? It's a giant desert. a blue pancake of blinding light and the occasional breaching wail. It's impossible for the human mind to comprehend, and yet the ancient Polynesians and Micronesians danced upon it like they were following waltz steps marked out on the floor. And so the old man's knowledge got passed on to his younger cousin, and three scientists watched the man navigate by feeling the wave refractions and wept, if I recall, as they witnessed a miracle, a total marvel, and just one of the many marvelous tales of Micronesian and Polynesian navigation. Or maybe it's only a marvel to me, and mostly because my directional sense is absolutely terrible, even on land, even in a place I've lived for years, especially in places I've never been. I'm a liability, a blight. I was once in Kiev, for example, directly after those fiery Iron Maidan protests of 2013. My bridge-burning surf book had just come out, and I thought I was back on my way to a meaningful destiny. I did not know yet I was running from it. My phone was not working, and thus I was Google Mapless. But wanting to get into the mix, I pushed off into the charred drizzle with nothing but joie de vivre and a fantastic pair of Saint Laurent sunglasses. Before long, I was hopelessly lost and stuck in some weird barracks of a protester practicing swordplay, mumbling what he was going to do to the Russians when they returned, swishing his blade right under my nose. I didn't know where I was, and I tried to leave, but he wouldn't let me unless I knew where I was going, because the Russians. And was I on their side? Was I on their team? Why was I wearing sunglasses? I asked for tea, eventually, and when he went to make it in a broken-down Volga he was using as a kitchen, I ran out into the streets, but got more lost, and had to spend time with two Ukrainians dressed as Eastern European Mickey Mouses, who proceeded to bore me with broken English and folk dances. Scientists call it the neurological effect of navigation by smartphone. Scientists say that our directional sense lives where our memory does, and when we wend around by using technology instead of our brains, we quite basically give ourselves Alzheimer's. That we never really know where we are in the world, and that puts humanity's very future in danger. All I know is that I'm an absolute directional catastrophe, and that my memory really is so bad that I've been accused of Alzheimer's more than once, and I blame navigating by my phone. Or playing football in 7th and 8th grade as the skinniest boy ever born. It's a nasty son of a bitch, and I sometimes wish I were an ancient Polynesian, because they could sail, but also because they had gorgeous tattoos, and it makes perfect sense in the end that a people who were able to understand the ocean so intimately, who navigated by the feeling of her undulations, would find pleasure in her waves, would understand them enough to ride them, to have fun on them, to bring surfing to each and every island they discovered. The crew of Captain James Cook are likely the first Europeans to ever witness surfing when the HMS Endeavour sailed past Tahiti during the summer of 1769, though Dr. Ben Finney, a Harvard-educated Pacific historian, suggests that proto-Polynesians had been surfing for 1,000 or so years. It was a kid's game, except on Marquesas, Tahiti, Hawaii, the Cook Islands, and New Zealand, where adults also rode waves. Only Tahitians and Hawaiians rode while standing, though, and only Hawaiians turned it into a national obsession, starting around 1500 A.D. It's a romantic tale that adds color to the scale-eyed surfer, maybe even a little bit of depth. Surfing was an activity of great kings, of conquerors, that traveled across the mighty Pacific from point to point, as if by magic, on the wings of men and women who felt the ocean with their bodies, with their souls. It's a beautiful ancient dance, and the surfer, a beautiful ancient dancer. And now, somehow, I've accidentally wandered back over to 5th Street. I can hear the empty din emanating from the Shorebreak's deck, floating down the street, and I can't remember where I parked my car. Ugh. I need to leave. I need to drive and forget this cursed life. So I fish my iPhone out of my pocket but it flips out of my APC raw jeans that I only just washed for the first time in 2 years yesterday, so they're twice as skinny, and the phone smashes into the ground. Shit. I look toward the heavens, toward the author of my fate, before bending over to grab my for sure cracked iPhone and realize I'm standing in front of Huntington Beach's International Surfing Museum. What are the fucking odds? I mean, that an international surfing museum exists is weird, sure, but that the dark night of my soul takes me right to it. In the window, there's a black and white picture of some South American mestizo-looking thing, grinning broadly, riding what appears to be a strange surfboard. Written in bold font, it says, "Surfing and Peru, 4,000 years. I freeze and feel the blood draining from my face. Did surfing actually start in Peru? Didn't cocaine? Shit. Chapter 3. Supernatural Aid. I couldn't turn my mind off that night. I'd somehow found my car using the decidedly not ancient Polynesian method of pressing my key's panic button until I heard the alarm wail, then driven home from Huntington Beach and the International Surfing Museum and the strange Peruvian as fast as my Volkswagen would carry me. Past Newport, Laguna, San Clemente, Camp Pendleton, Oceanside, Carlsbad, to Cardiff by the sea. In a mental fog, spinning. My wife was, thankfully, asleep when I got home. She would have been worried about me. I was worried about me. What the hell? Have surfing and cocaine really been locked in a loving embrace since the beginning of recorded time? Really? And if yes, how has this story never been written? Am I God's vessel? There's no way I'm God's vessel, because there's no way surfing actually started in Peru, right? And there's no way God likes cocaine, right? Isn't there a Bible verse about not being shallow? There totally is. The parable of the sower, where some of his seeds fall in good soil, some fall in no soil, and some fall in shallow soil. Isn't the shallow soil worst of all? I think it must be, but Peru? I don't know if surfing really started there, but I know someone who does, though he lives in Seattle, Washington, of all places, and is also an atheist. He dwells in a place where the sun literally doesn't shine. A place with no surf, but dramatic suicides. A place with very minimal God, and probably deep soil. The next day, I make the worst pot of French press coffee, which shoots all over the zinc kitchen counter that I'd insisted upon, aesthetically, even though sea air attaches to zinc and corrodes it almost instantly. I drop my iPhone again, sending an already broken piece flying off into my young daughter's toys. I forget to pick my wife's daughter up from soccer practice because I'm trying to research surf history online. And I know, by evening, there's only one way out. I have to go to Seattle. I have to see Matt Warshaw. He will fix me. He will set me straight. I tell my wife I need 24 hours, that I'm in the middle of an existential crisis and need answers. She can see the madness in my eyes and grants me leave. I book an Alaska Airlines flight, snag a rental car, drive through the rain and into an air of annoyance as the waiter in this wood-paneled, iron-railinged, reclaimed Queen Anne restaurant that I've arrived at is impatiently tapping his pen on his notebook, waiting for me to decide between a whiskey soda and a Moscow mule. He suggested a Kentucky mule 5 minutes ago, thinking it was an easy solution to my dilemma. A, mix it together and get a Kentucky mule. Problem solved. Except my problem is not solved because I don't want a Kentucky mule. I either want a whiskey drink or a vodka drink, not a whiskey drink masquerading as a vodka drink. Matt Warshaw sits across from me, drinking a glass of Sauvignon Blanc and smirking. His smirk is an almost permanent fixture these days. And I suppose it would be for me, too, if I were a surf historian instead of a surf journalist. Surf historian. Surf historian. Surf historian. The ludicrousness makes surf